This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
So when I was teaching on campus, I always had 5 minutes of meditation at the start of classes. And in the beginning of the semester, the students would be all at sea about it. You know, their phones were down, they were agitated, they were anxious, they wanted to, they couldn't sit still. They were having all kinds of difficulty with just that simple instruction. And I always think there's nothing actually easier than sitting still and doing nothing. But it turns out that's very challenging. And so by the middle of the semester, they were saying, because I would lock the door and say, if you come after the start of meditation, you have to wait until for 5 minutes until we begin the class. And so in the beginning, they would sort of straggle in, you know, late. And then they reached a point where they were gathering in the hall before the class, you know, like. And then by the middle of the semester, they were saying, why don't they do this in all of our classes? We're running around, we're so frantic, you know, we're on our text messages, we're running from class to class, and we're thinking about the next class and the homework, and we're just exhausted. And so they found it very nourishing. So it was really lovely to see that even that population, so technologically savvy and so busy, were really gratified and nourished by a little bit of silence, just a little bit of space of silence, stillness and silence. And so, of course, this is one of the key functions of spiritual practice, right? To bring us into that deep, deep stillness and silence. So I'm kind of curious, because I don't know all of you, how many of you have some kind of a meditation practice regularly? I'm not gonna quiz you on it, I'm just curious, you know, like, and some people don't at all. Some, who has no meditation practice and has never dabbled in it? Yeah, so this is a real mix of people who have some experience and people who have no experience. And I'm not going to talk too much about, you know, how to or how to do meditation or anything like that. I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think is what most people are asking for in the spiritual communities in which I do consulting now. So I do a fair amount of consulting with primarily Buddhist communities around issues of power and right use of power. So in every single faith tradition, there have been abuses of power. Some of them involve money. Some of them involve sort of throwing your weight around kind of power, abuses. And then some of them involve sexual indiscretions. So every single tradition, without exception, has this issue. And most of them have not addressed it particularly well. So I became very interested in this work as a result of doing some training called TACOMI, which is mind-body psychotherapy that's based on mindfulness and assisted self-study in mindfulness. So I started to get interested because I was studying to be a priest. Studying to be a priest, I thought, I need to know, you know, how to better connect with people's underlying core beliefs that are mistaken or that are misguided about themselves or about the world. So I did this training, and in the course of it, we learned about right use of power, which comes out of that training, and was developed by Cedar Barstow. So Cedar Barstow was one of the very first of the Hakomi trainers that Ron Kurtz trained. So as she watched what was going on, and he was trained in the Tibetan tradition, so it comes out of a very heartfelt and spiritual place. So what she began to notice was there had been a shift in psychotherapy, and the shift was a shift from the psychoanalyst who sits behind you and never interacts with you and just makes notes while you sort of free associate, typically male, to a different model where the therapist was like your friend. So your therapist is like your friend. They're there to support you and encourage you and help you. And in their role, they see themselves as basically a peer. As you might imagine, this created some problems. Therapists and clients finding themselves in the hot tub together, or worse. All kinds of abuses of power that resulted from confusion about the power up, power down, inevitable dynamic of having a role. So she began, because she had a master's in adult education, she began to create this training called Right Use of Power. She said, I don't want to kind of the typical kind of ethics training that people come out of feeling beaten up or feeling like, oh, now here's all these rules I'm never even going to be able to remember, or, you know, the sort of dry lectures and things like that. So she designed experiential exercises that help people understand and explore their edges around power. So when I came along, I became extremely interested in the particular application of this model in spiritual communities. Spiritual communities create special problems for the right use of power, primarily because of its denial. So we're supposed to be humble. We're supposed to be self-effacing. This is noble. It's noble not to want power or to actually claim your power unless you're a certain kind of person who is has an appetite for power, shall we say. And then you can wreak a lot of havoc, right? But for the most part, in spiritual communities, the community itself is supposed to be very uninterested in power, and power dynamics are not supposed to be at play, which means they all go underground and become toxic. So, sadly, right? So you have these factions, or you have these, you know, people who don't speak to each other for 25 years. I mean, that was the case in the English department anyway. So you have this, because people are supposed to be spiritual and not interested in power, and many people, in fact, flee into spiritual community out of abuses of power in other places because they're seeking a place where power doesn't apply, right? So they can just be spiritual. And this creates lots and lots of problems. As you can probably witness if you open the newspaper anytime soon or read on the screen about what's happening in various spiritual traditions. So I just did a training with Shambhala Center here because their the head of their national organization had harassment charges against him, sexual assault charges against him, was outed as a hard drinker and partier. And that was not what the people in that organization believed about him. And so they're working through as a sangha, even though they're in their own community, there was no real scandal, they're working through the fact that they have a model at which the person at the top is sort of like a guru, you know? And so they wanted to learn about right use of power as a way to talk about power openly and without shame or blame. So that's what that's the way we work with right use of power, is standing in your strength and staying in your heart. So using power wisely and well is the focus of this particular kind of training, which is experiential. So I've been really interested in how to help spiritual communities develop a culture of being able to talk about power and how it's manifesting in the community, and just develop ways of talking about it and ways of exploring it that are not hurtful and that are not shaming and that are not blaming. So the first thing that we begin to teach about is that there are three basic kinds of power that you see operating. The first one is personal power. So personal power is just the power you have by virtue of being a human being. So if you want to understand the function of personal power, all you need to do is go and stand slightly too close to someone. It's impactful, right? So we have personal power that's just our birthright. We just own it, you know, because we're human beings. And so we have an impact on one another, and that impact may be positive, may be negative, might be neutral, but we have an impact. We're well aware when there's another person in the room and when the room is empty, right? And we're well aware when certain people show up and when certain people are missing. So that's just the personal power. And then the second kind of power is role power, which is an add-on to personal power. And role power is not something you can escape, no matter how humble you think you are. You have a role, and that role confers upon you certain privileges and certain perks, which are necessary to that role, but which also create a power differential with others. So, and those roles might be variable, and you might switch them out. They're not necessarily permanent, but they're conveyed by the role. Someone who's a priest has a role, and that's a power add-on. Someone who's a head of a corporation has a role. That's a power add-on. But it happens even at much lower levels, like at in our community, we have councils, and councils are a small group of experienced students who are committed to the well-being of the community. So they have some peer support so that, we can do some training with them so that they can engage in projects together and help support the community. So they don't think of themselves as any different from anybody else. But to the rest of the Sangha, they have some special status. And so one of their privileges is they meet with me once a week. I don't think that's such a big privilege. That's a burden, you know? But in view of the rest of the Sangha, that's a little special extra, right? So there are these privileges and perks that come as a function of having power. There are also inevitably some, as social science research shows us, some changes that happen to us cognitively. So they're a function of just assuming a role, which is in some sort of power-up position. So one of those is a reduction in empathy. Uh-oh. You know, this happens automatically no matter how well-meaning you are, how compassionate you are, how kind you are. There's a reduction in empathy. Why? You have a larger view. You're responsible for more of the whole, right? So if this is going to make Ethel unhappy, well, there's nothing that we can do to prevent that because we have charge of the whole, right? So, and if you have an exceedingly empathic person in that kind of a role position, they become ineffectual. They're so empathic that they're not going to do anything that's going to hurt anybody's feelings or that's going to make anybody upset or distressed. That's going to be the barrier right there. So these privileges and perks also create cognitive changes. You can work to offset those cognitive changes. So for example, reduction in empathy, then you want to make sure that you get lots and lots of appropriate feedback, which helps you understand your impact better, right? Because one of the things that happens is we discover that our intention and our impact are two different things. And you cannot excuse the impact by saying you had a good intention. Right? So instead you have to deal with the impact. So, and most people who are in some kind of a power-up position are completely oblivious to the outsized impact their words and gestures and even their silence has. Right? So in spiritual communities, we often don't understand the way that we are viewed as being in some power-up position even when we're not feeling that. So as I always say it, at my sangha, if you've been here once before and you know where the bathrooms are, as far as anyone new coming in the door is, you're an abbot. Like, they don't have any way to discern whether you aren't in some, you know, like enormously responsible position because you're able to point out where the bathrooms are. So that person, you don't feel especially powerful, but you know, suddenly you're viewed that way. And so part of what we do work with the councils is for them to understand that their perception of how they're viewed and how they're actually viewed are quite different. So I had this forcefully driven home to me when I first got my job at UT, and I just was coming out of graduate school. And so I started hanging out in this little skunk works that was working on how to use technology to improve teaching in the humanities. And so it was a bunch of graduate students and another faculty member, and I would just hang out and like build stuff and see if it worked and if it didn't work, try it out in classes, things like that. So I came out of a meeting, one of those, you know, little informal meetings that we have, and one of the graduate students stopped me and he said, "You can't talk like that in the meeting." And I said, "Well, what do you mean? I don't know what you're talking about." And he said, "No, you can't talk like that." And I said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "You know, because you just can't." And I said, "Well, my opinion's just like anybody else's." And he said, "No, it's not. You're a faculty member." And that was the first notion I had that there would be any difference between being a graduate student and a faculty member, and that it would be perceived as problematic in some way. Like, I was just, "La, la, 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 la. Here I'm new to a job, you know, I'm just a skunk works over here, you know." And so, so it was really an eye-opener for me, the ways in which we're oblivious to the impact of a perceived role difference, right? You have some well-defined ones here, like priest or bishop. They're well-defined roles. But you also have some roles that are perceived but not necessarily experienced that way. It's inevitable. A person greeting people at the door, whatever, you know. So you think you're just serving a function. And you're perceived as having some status or some standing. So the third kind of power, type of power that we talk about is status power. The status power is a little bit different. It's culturally conferred. And status power may or may not be associated with a role, but it has to do with what's perceived as a special power add-on. So, for example, in some, and it's situational. So in some situations, being married is an advantage. But in other situations, being married, big disadvantage. Being tall might be an advantage when being considered for a promotion, you know. In another situation, not such a big advantage, bumping your head all the time. So there's like, status differences have to do with those kinds of things. You're white, that's an advantage in some neighborhoods, big disadvantage in some other neighborhoods. You're well-educated, big advantage in some situations. Bad advantage with your, disadvantage with your ignorant Uncle Harry who's, demagogue and a racist. So you're like, okay, in this situation. So that's more negotiated in a sense by the situation and the sort of perceptions of the people in the situation. So we do some little exercises to demonstrate this for people a little bit. And I'm wondering if you might be interested in playing a little bit with this, because hearing about it is one thing, but getting a felt sense of it is another. And so we do some little non-harming and non-threatening experiments in mindfulness in order to explore that. Are you interested in that?
Sure.
Yeah, okay, so you're game, okay. So for this, you need a partner, and you need to move your chair so that you're sitting knee to knee, but not touching, but facing your partner. So you have a partner, you're sitting across from your partner, and you're sitting with your, don't be manspreading, and you're sitting with your knees close but not touching, right? And now you're going to be invited to become mindful and close your eyes. In these little exercises, we are studying our own internal experience, what automatically and naturally arises when something happens. So it might be nothing. Nothing might change. Something might change. But what in this particular exercise, what you're going to do is, whenever you are ready, you're going to open your eyes, take a snapshot of the person in front of you, and close your eyes again and study what automatically arose, right? And they are going to be doing the same thing. So when you look at them, their eyes might be open, their eyes might be closed. You're just studying what happens. And you can just repeat this for a little bit. Just close your eyes and study. Open your eyes, get a little snapshot. Close your eyes and study, right? So you can begin, and I'll ring a bell to stop, so you don't have to worry about that. You're just at your own pace, mindfully noticing what automatically arises, if anything. And you're just studying your own experience. And now with your eyes open, you're just going to be looking at your partner's face as if you're going to do a drawing or painting of it. So you're looking at textures, colors, shapes, forms, just exactly as if you were going to do a little painting or a little drawing. And these planes and colors and shapes were going to be what you're capturing in your drawing. Shadows and highlights. Eyebrows, shape of the lips, just like you're an artist. And now looking in the same way, you're looking at this partner's face and noticing if you see any signs of suffering. Looking for signs of suffering. Finally, you're going to be looking in exactly the same way, and you're going to see that your partner is like a mirror. So you're looking at your partner as a mirror. Take just a moment and thank your partner and discuss with your partner just for a moment or two what that experience was like for you. Experiment, you got a lot of data, it seems. Did you get a lot of data? What did you discover? What did you discover? You can't stop talking about it, right? What did you learn? I mean, these are experiments, you know? So in these experiments, we're just making discoveries. So. Thank you.
Wait a minute, they're still talking. Wow, you guys are not like Buddhists. Buddhists obey the bell. Well, I can see this is a very lively conversation. So you were saying what you noticed. You speak up so people can hear you.
When she asked us to look at another person's face and think about it in terms of suffering, I've seen that. And yet I know all of us experience suffering repeatedly in our lives, but hers is well integrated. It isn't at all. She looks happy. But there were people I passed on the street on the way in here who show it very plainly that they're in the midst of it.
And what did you notice about personal power when you were opening your eyes and just looking like there's just a person there? So there's the impact of that. What did you notice?
I can't really speak to that. Has someone else?
Yes.
I felt like it was, at moments, it was too intimate. Like I was invading Irene's personal space.
Yeah, because we don't often look like that. Yeah. We don't often have permission to look like that. Yeah.
So I got nervous.
It can feel intrusive, yeah. Yeah. Some of us have family conditioning around that too, you know. Yes?
Well, when I first closed my eyes, I felt this connection, like an energy connection, like we're in this little bubble together.
Uh-huh.
Something, it felt good, like a positive interaction with a human.
Yeah. It's just the impression of being so you felt like you were intrusive and you felt like this intimacy was welcome.
Yeah.
One thing that came to my mind is that as I was looking at Ellen, a lot of what I did was projection.
Yes. That's what you notice, right? You noticed right away. Yeah, we start with the stories, we start with the, you know, interpretations. Oh, she's got her eyes open. Oh, that's a good thing. Oh, no, wait, she closed her eyes. She doesn't like me, you know. You see how little interaction can make huge, you can make huge interpretations, right? Yeah, Doug.
I felt like I really needed to ask a lot of questions.
Oh, yeah.
By talking to them,
yeah. So when we stop our habitual tendency, then we have a chance to study something that is different, right? And one of the things I discovered, because I'm a talker too, you know, that's why I do this. One of the things I discovered was that I never knew that 80% of our communication is nonverbal. So I always thought the words were carrying the day, you know, but it's not true. Yeah, so when we drop the words, and that's part of what we do when we go into silence, we have an opportunity to see, oh, I'm depending a lot on my language. I'm depending a lot on hearing and talking and interacting with people verbally, right? Yeah, and I'm blissfully unaware that this body itself has an impact, right? Yeah.
Of course, this is my daughter, so that was sort of unfair.
And you were paired up? Yeah.
But in the last part, when you said to think you're looking at yourself, Frederick Buechner writes about understanding the Trinity by looking in a mirror, which is very powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's what...
Yeah, and our children are a certain kind of mirror, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for better or worse.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I should know your name.
Nancy.
The perspective that hit me when you were speaking, Nancy, is Mom commented, because I've had, like we all have, a lot of suffering in my life, and she noticed that my face doesn't show it, which is partly great genes, partly I'm wondering, because you commented on the people of the street, if our faith, we know how much our faith helps us in our day-to-day struggles. So is that partly why we manage to look more health, you know, healthier, because our faith helps us in our day-to-day struggles, whereas perhaps some of the people who, you know, maybe don't have that gift of faith.
Or is it just a better mask?
Yeah, because we don't actually know that the person who seems to us is a suffering person.
Well, 100% of people suffer. That's the Buddha's teaching. 100%. 100% of people are born. 100% of people will get sick. 100% of people will die. 100% of people will have to be with people they don't like and things, situations they don't like. And you know, 100% of people will be apart from situations and people that they do like. So 100% suffering. And so, you know, for me, it means that the reason we teach right use of power is so that we can avoid adding even a single atom of suffering to what's already present. So that's part of how I think about it, you know. And it may not be apparent, but I guarantee you, you will, if you talk to anyone long enough, you'll discover the sources of their suffering, both past and present, and sometimes even future, right?
I didn't mean to imply in any way that just because your life circumstances at that moment mean that you're on the street doesn't mean that you don't have faith.
No, that's true.
That
No. Yeah. I don't think anybody got that implication yet.
I was just trying to say that maybe a couple of people that you have in the past at that moment, maybe they didn't have that. Whereas we're assuming if we're in this room that we're working on ours and it's important to
right.
us, or we wouldn't be here.
Right, yeah. So it's just a little embodied way to understand our impact on each other and the ways in which we automatically start constructing ideas or connecting with other things, experiences that we've had, or telling a story, or that's what we observe. I mean, that's if we're going to be good observers, we need to know that, and without a lot of judgment, like that's a bad thing to do, or you shouldn't do that, or you should do that, you know, but to actually say, oh, this arises in me. So in the Buddha's teaching, he didn't pronounce things as good or evil. He would say, this is unwholesome, so abandon it. He had his criteria, you know. If this is unwholesome, abandon it. And it wasn't a judgment that was implied, other than that the action or the behavior or whatever is going to cause suffering or would be disapproved by the wise or doesn't lead to freedom. So, and he said, don't be guided by what you've read or what people tell you or what you think is popular or because this person's an expert. You know, we have all this now amplified with technology where you're reading stuff online and people are actually projecting more expertise or authority onto online stuff that they read, no matter how crazy it is, than the people who are right in front of them. So I think it's really important to have this understanding. I mean, one of the most important things we can do to rebuild networks of trust in our society is to be in presence with each other and be awake to the suffering. And it's not something abstract that's happening in a war far, far away. It's happening in the person right in front of you. So I think that's a big part of what we want to do. So in the right use of power model, Cedar has organized our understanding about the appropriate and wise use of power in four dimensions. So, and she uses the cardinal directions as a kind of orienting principle. So in the East is informed use of power. And this means that people understand what are the codes and guidelines that pertain to their situation. So if you're a therapist, you have codes and guidelines and ethical conduct guidelines that you are required to follow, and same for clergy, right? So do they know what they are? Are they informed enough to know what those are? Like, you don't do this, you don't do this, or you should do this, or you should, or this causes problems. And she has this wonderful way of expressing this as these codes and guidelines are the received wisdom of people who have experienced a lot of issues, you know? So over time, we've built up these sets of codes, that whatever they are, whatever we're being guided by, but those codes in our tradition, it's the precepts. They're a source of wisdom. They're not just a source of control and regulation, they're a source of wisdom. And so the Buddhist project was not a self-improvement project. He was not teaching us how to be a better person. His actual project was to build a better civilization. So a civilization was in transition from warring kingdoms, plundering, raping, you know, murdering each other, to city-states that were, you know, going to be more civilized and larger groups of people living together. And in order for that to happen in peace and harmony, he recognized that there were some things that people would have to agree to, like to not kill each other, right? Not take things from each other, not misuse sexuality, not intoxicate themselves. And all of the precepts come out of that, not so much you will be a bad person if you don't do these things, but if a civilization is going to survive and if it is going to be healthy, these are the things that provide a harmonious coexistence, let's say. So it's all relational. So in the East, we have the informed use of power. And then in the South quadrant is the compassionate use of power. So it's the caring use of power. The way a parent cares for a child, right? Where you have this utmost concern for the person's well-being and growth and development. And that caring expression of power is something that we often don't talk about when we talk about power, because we have so many negative associations with power, right? We think of power as oppression or cruelty or violence or control, or and the other side of that is responsibility and care and guidance. So those are all those aspects of the South sort of quadrant of this model. And the West is accountable or connected use of power. So that's where you're in a power-up position. You're accountable. So we're seeing now a lot of problems with situations where people are not allowing themselves to be held accountable. They don't consider themselves accountable. That's very problematic, right? So that may mean you're going to have to deal with some aspects of power missteps, including shame. So we talk about ways that we understand shame in power dynamics. Yes?
Who are you talking about?
Who am I talking about in the public sphere? Many, many leaders now are experiencing themselves. For example, in this Shambhala organization that I originally talked about, the person at the top, the guru for the whole organization, issued a non-apology kind of statement in which... it's the kind of non-apology where you say, if people feel they were hurt, I'm sorry to hear about that, basically, you know. So that's without any sense of shame or accountability, right? And people being left in positions of power, you have it in the Catholic Church, you know, people being not only being left in positions of power, but being moved around so that they can't be accountable, and the institution itself not being accountable. So this is really problematic, right? So that... West quadrant is about accountability and about staying connected, even in conflict, which is a very difficult thing to do, right? We want to disengage, we want to deny, we want to do anything, disappear, rather than to stay present and to stay connected, right? So we're having some kind of a problem. I want to know about it, I want feedback, I want to hear about it, and I want to be able to deal with it together. So that's that whole quadrant. And that's a lot of that is about getting good feedback and how to give and receive feedback. So we have like a whole day's training on that, just the qualities of good feedback as received, you know, and the ways that people receive feedback. And then the north quadrant of this model is about the skillful use of power. So there are skills to be mobilized in using power wisely and well, one of which is asking for feedback, one of which is checking for the impact of something that you've said or done with someone who's in a power-down position because they're not likely to bring it forward. So there's skillful uses of power. And among other things, one of the things in this teaching is not using your power, not stepping into your power, is itself an abuse of power. So it's really important to recognize
You may think you can suck back and be humble, but now you are actually abusing the power that is that is your personal power or your role power. So it's very, very important to recognize when the exercise of your power is the right use of power. I can give you an example from when I was on campus and I was running the computer writing and research lab. And in one of the classrooms that was a lab classroom, but which I wasn't responsible for because it was an English department class, creative writing class, there was a young, a very attractive graduate student teacher. And she was, I think it probably was about her second year of teaching. And in her class was a veteran. And he was probably in his 30s. And he began writing very assaultive kinds of work. So he wrote a poem about putting a woman in a wood chipper, and then he handed it to her and said, "This is for you." So I didn't know this was going on for a little while in my lab classrooms. And so when I found out, I went directly to the department chair's, the other department chair's office, and I said, "She's not going back in that classroom as long as he's there. You either pull him out and give him private instruction with one of the male faculty members, or you find someone else to teach that class." And he said, "Well, I think she's just being a little hysterical, you know." And she probably weighed 98 pounds, you know, blonde and blue-eyed. And so I said, "No, this is my lab. You will not be able to run this class in this lab unless you fix this situation. She's not going back there." So that was a place I had to step into power. And, you know, I'm a new faculty member, and I'm going toe-to-toe with the department chair of a gigantic department. And I thought this could be toast for my career, but I don't care, you know. This is really has to happen. So we have to step forward. So I always encourage people to recognize if you have privilege, don't be ashamed of it. Step into it and use it. Use it for the benefit of people who can't be heard in the places where you can be heard, who can't be seen in the places where you can be seen. And speak up. You know, so that's really, really critical. And so I know that, you know, a lot of us have had the experience of hearing about privilege and feeling beaten down by it, you know, like, yes, you know, I have a comfortable existence and I'm a white person and, you know, no, that gives you a certain standing in places where other people can't be heard. Use it. Be happy to have the resources that can actually make a difference with people who otherwise wouldn't have any way to hear it. So I think we're pretty close to the end of our time, and I wanted to make sure that I answer any questions you might have. There's a whole, like, there's 2 days of solid, of little experiential experiments like you just did that we use in this kind of training. But I also wanted to answer any questions you might have about Zen or about Buddhism or about Appomattox. So we have a little bit of time, I think. Right? It's like, yeah, a few minutes. Yes?
I think that self-reflection is easy to do, and self-reflection about your own power is easy to do. What I find to be tremendously difficult is when you see other people who are not self-reflective about their power, how do you gently, I don't know how to gently intervene or open their eyes. That, to me, has always been the hardest challenge.
It's really challenging. So what you're talking about is giving feedback. And I actually can recommend a book to you which is about the opposite, receiving feedback, called Thanks for the Feedback. It's by the two people who wrote Difficult Conversations, and it's from the Harvard Negotiation Project. And if you understand what they're talking about, it also teaches you how to give feedback better. So they talk about 3 triggers that prevent people from being able to make use of feedback. So the first one is the reality trigger. When you hear it, this just isn't true. What you observed, you didn't see, this absolutely isn't true, right? So they have a different view of reality than you have. And so it might be because it's happening in their blind spot. It might be because it actually isn't true. There are lots of different reasons why that might be a barrier, but it's a barrier to receiving feedback, even feedback that you want to get. Second trigger is relationship trigger. How can you, my very best friend, be telling me this? You know, why have you waited so long? Or what it has to do with the relationship, like, you're not in a position to say this to me, or whatever, right? The relationship. And you haven't known me that long, or whatever. So the third one is
the trigger that has to do with identity. And it's where you feel like the ground fall out from under you. Like, how could anybody think I'm dishonest? You know, like my whole life is built on my integrity, you know? Like where it sort of shakes your whole sense of who you are. So you can't really make use of that feedback as a result of those triggers. And then there are three, I think four, types of feedback. And one of the things that will happen is you'll get a type of feedback or give a type of feedback that the person's not expecting. So my example, so I'll tell you what the types are. The first type of feedback is appreciation. I see you, you're doing a great job. Thank you so much for helping us around here. It's fantastic that you keep showing up in this way, right? This is appreciation. The second type of feedback is coaching. Okay, let me show you how we do this. I can see you're a little confused about this. So let me show you how we do this. It's intended to help the person learn and grow. The third type, in my model, it's not in the book quite this way because they use this as also coaching feedback, but I think of it as something different. Relationship feedback. There's some problem in our relationship, and here's how I see it, and I want to fix it, or I want it remedied somehow, right? And the fourth type is evaluation. You're 19th in your class. You swam this mile in so many minutes. It's usually some sort of comparison with a standard or an ideal or some other expectation. And so those are the types of feedback. So what happens when there's a mismatch between the feedback type you're expecting and the feedback type I'm giving you? Problems, right? And so my quick example of this, I know we're out of time, my quick example of this is when I was in graduate school, my graduate advisor would read my drafts and he'd write comments on them, right? Yes, they do. And the comments were invariably very positive. So they were like, I like this point, or you did a good job with this, or they were all like that, right? I was bereft. Positive feedback from my advisor. I was bereft. I knew he was tearing apart the papers of my peers. And I thought, he doesn't even think I'm worth bothering about. He just thinks I'm like a housewife or something. You know, he doesn't really care to improve me. So I was expecting coaching or evaluation, one or the other, but what I got was appreciation. The thought never, ever crossed my mind until after graduate school that he actually liked my work and didn't have anything to add. I never had that thought, you know? He retired after me, and he said to my supervisor that I was working for, he said, "What a way to go out." And I thought, what? He liked my work? I mean, I was dumbfounded. So when there's a match between the types, I'm expecting coaching and you're giving me coaching, it's a happy scene, even if it's like critical, right? Because I feel like I'm learning something. Thank you for criticizing me, you know? Like, but if we're expecting appreciation and we get evaluation, we're like, wait, what? You know? I'm working my butt off around here and nobody seems to even notice. So the advantage is, if you understand this, you can prep the person for the type of feedback you're going to be giving. And you can let them set the time when that's gonna happen. And you can understand that they might be triggered by the relationship or by the reality of it, or, you know. So if you understand that, then you have much more chance of success. Even more important is to be proactive in asking for the kind of feedback that you want. Would you coach me on this? Because I'm not really sure how this goes. You know, and not to assume that coaching feedback is evaluation feedback, which carries a kind of judgment with it, right? So anyway, so that's I think that book would be very helpful in that situation. And thank you, everybody, for coming.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.